Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, okay, I'm not way computer savvy girl, right? And
right.
I don't spend a whole lot of time on the computer.
I do, but I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, among other things. But I honestly, most impressive gardening blog that I've ever seen, managed by, what, three or four women?
Four women and a guy. And,
well, he's
late arrival.
Guest contributor.
Okay.
I would say he's any part of the management. okay. But Susan Harris is joining us today. She's one of the people that's a part of GardenRant.com.
Yeah.
It's a gardening blog. But, like, it's thoughtful and it, you know, as Bob likes to say, it pushes the envelope in terms of, it's not like, ooh, we're going to talk about gardening and this is what you're supposed to do and it's time to plant your bulbs. But they're like, tired of fancy schmancy representations,
right.
You know, in magazines,
yeah,
and on telly and, you know, all that, that they really are talking about gardening in a more sort of serious way that we would if we were sitting around the kitchen table having coffee, you know?
With people you really liked.
Yeah, and they're smart and articulate
and fun,
all that.
Yeah. And they're flabbergasted at no-maintenance mm-hmm. gardens and things
yeah.
like that. So
yeah.
It really is funny. I bumped into this rant accidentally and I go to it a lot now and read
it. Do
you?
Yeah, because one of the contributors is Amy Stewart, and Amy's been on our show
right.
Before as well. We interviewed her for one of her books, Flower Confidential, but then she also wrote a book called The Earth Moved about earthworms. So, you know, some really smart, engaging people that are a part of this garden rant. So we're going to talk to Susan Harris about that, and local holly expert Bob Hopkins is coming into the studio to talk about hollies.
I would like to remind listeners again to grab a pencil for this because he's going to mention some particular hollies that you might want to try for your mm-hmm. yard. And it's the holiday season, and hollies kind of go with that. But he'll talk a lot about deciduous hollies, which is a great winter-burying holly,
mm-hmm.
as well as some of the American, some newer cultivars that get, look at kind of conical, 20, 30 feet tall and wide, and they're beautiful berries, and I like the plant a lot.
I do too. But the plant being a very diverse plant in
right.
terms of hollies, because the quintessential Ilex opaca is the American holly.
Right.
But then you've got hollies that people are like, that's not a holly because it's got, you know, a small round leaf and
right.
it's not spiny or whatever. So, you know, open your minds to the possibilities that the term holly suggests.
And also be sure and go to our website after the show and you'll have some information on holly associations you can join and hollies you might want to try and mm-hmm. just holly it up.
Yeah, that put the image to the words that we will be saying to be sure.
It's the holiday season.
It is the holiday season. You're right.
I know.
There's something to that,
yeah,
Mr. Hill.
I know.
All right, what's going on in your garden?
Speaking of the holiday season, I visited my daughter up in Michigan
mm-hmm.
over Thanksgiving for a week. Had a great time, and a friend of hers father has a blueberry nursery.
Uh-huh.
And he grows them because he's got a bog.
Okay.
And he gave me two blueberry plants.
Good.
I'm not sure how well they're going to do because these plants are growing in a bog. When you dug them out, it was like peat.
Huh.
And it was wet and it was just mm-hmm. perfect. But I'm trying to rush this thing. I bought some babies a couple of years ago and they're only about 2 feet tall. Yeah, so I dug up some big blueberries. I'm bringing them home. I'm going to put them in the ground. I'm going to give them all the peat moss and acid and love mm-hmm. and pine cone stuff they can stand. I'm going to see what happens, but I'm just yeah. trying to save myself a couple of years here.
Yeah, and hopefully they'll adapt to, like, the not-so-boggy here because they don't have to have boggy, but if they grew up boggy,
right.
they may have a little bit of an adjustment period.
I've got a counselor and two psychiatrists
okay,
on hand
good.
To talk to these plants.
Good, good.
I love blueberries. This is going to happen.
That's right.
How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
Well, chicken update.
Chicken update, is that
chicken
one word?
Chicken update.
Well, that's two words. Okay.
Although I don't have any roosters. So the girls are molting.
Oh, no.
So, no, I think it's normal.
It is.
It's not a bad thing.
It sounds like, oh, my God.
It's kind of a natural process, sort of like...
A molting.
You know, evergreens have to shed leaves from time to time. Leaves don't last forever. Well, chickens, their feathers don't last forever. So certain times of the year, and this is one of them, they start to molt. And remember I was telling you about Pluck, who actually got pecked on?
Oh, I know.
And she looks beautiful again. She's
all right.
filled back out. She's fine. You know, we protected her so her feathers would fill
she's
back out.
She's remolted.
Mm-hmm. But then we thought other girls were getting pecked on,
our
Pluck dad, right?
Yeah.
But then I looked in the book and nobody was bleeding or anything like that like Pluck had been. So we determined that the chickens were molting, a very natural process. Their feathers are growing back rather quickly, filling out. But when you molt, you don't produce
eggs. Oh, no.
I'm like getting zero egg production.
You look a little jaundiced lately, too.
I know. I think the, let's see, eggs for 2 days and then you get one egg.
Oh, man.
No eggs for 2 days and then you get one egg.
Well, if you were a chicken, you wouldn't lay an egg either at this stage of the game.
Probably not. No. So I'm not mad at them by any means, okay. But I was just a little disappointed. Well, and you too, because if I only get one egg every couple days, you get no eggs.
You can bring in a half an egg if you don't. I'm molting. Yeah.
So apparently it's completely natural for chickens to molt this time of the year, old feathers for new, and it's also perfectly natural for them to produce no eggs.
Croakers.
I may have to.
Croakers.
I don't have to yet.
Okay.
But I may have to in the future. I'll go to a farmer's market instead. How about that?
I got you.
All right, Bob, you spend a lot of time cruising the internet in the winter months?
More than I do in the summertime, and more. And I came across this garden rant and thought we should talk to one of the people and see if we can get her on the show.
Sounds good. And we did indeed. Her name is Susan Harris. She's one of the founding members of Garden Rant, whose subtitle is Uprooting the Gardening World. Susan, along with Michelle Owens, Amy Stewart, and Elizabeth Licata, provide engaging conversation, ideas, musings, and good old-fashioned critiques about gardeners, gardens, and gardening. Susan, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Great. The Garden Rant has officially been online since June of 2006.
Correct.
But we want to know how it was conceived of, all the stuff that was going on before you actually got online.
It took months of plotting via email. Mm-hmm. It was actually conceived of by one of our writers in New York, Michelle Owens, uh-huh. and she had a career as a writer in politics and business, but wanted to get out there and kind of make a name for herself as a writer in the gardening world, uh-huh. and also wanted to change the conversation. She said, hey, you know, there's the stuff that she wanted to talk about she never saw in the gardening magazines. Mm-hmm. So she thought that it would be great if we had new articles every day, and mm-hmm. that she didn't have enough time to do that, and that's why she decided to look for some partners.
Had you known her before?
Well, we all had individual blogs.
Okay.
So I was reading her, and she was reading me and Amy Stewart. And mm-hmm. so Amy's the first person she recruited. She had read Amy's book about gardening and loved her writing. So that was she said that was job one, was to recruit Amy. And then together they chose me. They tell me, based on a rant that I had written on my individual blog, about Jerry Baker, who is calls himself America's Master Gardener.
Right.
So they said, oh, she looks like a troublemaker. We want her.
So this was a personal blog initially. It wasn't a garden rant per se at that time.
Right. They were all individual gardening blogs. So I think we had one phone call that I was involved in, then lots and lots of emails. Mm-hmm. And I was in charge of finding the designer who did our masthead. And, you know, somebody else was in charge of the technical part. And it took about 4 months, and then we launched in June. And then 6 months later, we took on our fourth, another New York writer, Elizabeth, in Buffalo.
Okay.
So now we have a full... And recently, we took on our first regular contributor, our first man.
Alan Armitage.
Yeah.
I know. That's quite a coup,
yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah.
Very
We're
exciting.
Thrilled.
Yeah, I'd say so. So are you all still able to manage your own personal gardening blogs then?
Not so much. No, in fact, Michelle has ended hers. I think the rant has become like the first love for all of us, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, because I've tried gardening blog here with little success, frankly, and yours seems much more usable, user-friendly, and so forth. Kind of talk about that a little bit. How did you, when you started this thing, how did you get the word out initially? How do you throw a blog out there for people to respond to?
Right. Well, we all announced it on our individual blogs, of course. And I think I always tell people the most helpful way to get your new blog noticed is to go around all the other garden blogs out there and read and make interesting comments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you always leave your little link, and they'll say, oh, that's a new person, and they'll check you out. So just to be active in the blog, the conversation going on in the blogosphere, as we say, that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Susan, so what qualifies as an interesting comment? And I think, you know, that kind of lends itself to the gardening manifesto that is ultimately what the blog is about, or I guess the perspective that you guys are coming from.
Right.
So what qualifies as interesting and engaging to you all is really what makes the Garden Rant so special, I think. So can you give our listeners an idea of what your manifesto is, which is right there, you know, on that front page of the blog?
Well, bored with perfect magazine garden.
That's wonderful.
That tells
it
you
is
a lot. Wonderful, yeah.
And suspicious of the horticultural industry.
Amen.
Yeah. And appalled by chemical warfare in the garden.
Good.
And then some of the comments we've gotten from our readers describing, also I kind of think, tell you what makes an interesting comment, too, is they describe Garden Rant as sassy, provocative, cheeky, irreverent, and funny.
All of the above. You're also in love with real, rambling, chaotic, dirty, bug-ridden gardens.
That's right.
You
the
go,
real
girl.
Yeah, it's like real gardening perspectives, I suppose,
right.
is why
That's
it resonates
right.
with so many people. So can you get sort of a profile of your readers from the comments that you get back from them?
I don't think so, because we have over 1,000 readers a day, but maybe, 20 will leave a comment.
Okay.
So we always try to keep that in mind, that our commenters, although we love them and they really make it such a fun community, that they really don't reflect the average reader.
Okay.
So most people never peep up at all.
So what are some of the most interesting stories you guys have posted in the past year?
Let's see. Well, amazingly, we had Alan Armitage wrote about whether to have Latin or common names on plants, and we had... a gazillion comments on that. Who knew that that would evoke such strong feeling? But also we've had big comments. We've compiled our top comment getters of the year. We haven't done it yet for 08, but in 07, people compare whether they thought magazines were better than gardening catalogs or vice versa. And lots of rants about a New York Times story that didn't, that talked about eating locally but didn't even mention growing it yourself.
I got a little ranty about that one day myself.
Right. I think it was characterized as, people in the big city writing about something they know nothing about.
Right.
To that end, you had Michael Pollan, who we had on the show, and Bill Moyers talking about the power of the individual garden, how you can just, in your own backyard, you can raise enough stuff that you're giving things away. And that's kind of where it begins.
That's right, and that's the particular passion of Michelle, who started Garden Rant, and she has a lot to say about that. And she's always trying to say, look, it's easy. For example, in contrast to Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, Michelle's take is that, you don't have to devote your whole life to it, that it's easy to just grow something on your property.
So in terms of the blog, you not only include comments from the women and now from the one man, Alan Armitage.
And gaining, I hope.
But you also kind of provide links and direction into other topics, yes?
Well, yes, and I think that's one of the most fun things about writing on the web is that you don't have to say everything. You can link to whole other conversations. It's funny, the theory has changed. It used to be that you wanted your blog or your website to be sticky and keep the readers there. And now, the more links, the better, almost. And so, you start a conversation. I don't think any of us see it that we have to say everything, but we want to get the conversation started, and you continue it and give people references to go find out more themselves by linking.
Yeah. Now, do you each get a week, and then every 4 weeks, or whenever you want to pop in, do you pop in?
Oh, no popping.
So what's the responsibility?
We have assigned days. We're very organized.
Okay.
We wanted every day to have at least one new article.
Okay, so you take turns, basically.
We take turns, yeah. And then, if somebody is sick or out of town, we coordinate behind the scenes. But.
Susan, is there any sort of, criteria or rules that you guys follow amongst yourselves in terms of ideas and topics and rants?
Well, I think what makes it work so well is that we don't coordinate at all about what we're going to say. In fact,
that's
have no
good.
Idea
yeah.
what somebody else is going to pop up with the next day. I mean, I read Garden Rant on the days that I haven't posted with as much curiosity as anyone. And so it means that we don't have to agree on very much. And in fact, we disagree all the time.
Yeah.
So we go ahead and post whatever we feel like it. And there's no problem. We don't have to speak as one. In fact, some people react as though we do speak as one, and I always say, no, we're four different people and now five different people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we chose each other based on what we were already blogging about.
Yeah, it's so personal, which makes it interesting to me. I mean, your latest posting is about a Facebook hippie boyfriend reunion. Talk about that a little bit, because that was a neat story.
That was a neat story.
I enjoyed reading that.
Oh, great. Well, I daringly went off topic slightly there, but I thought, well, since I had reunited with my college hippie boyfriend via Gardner Ant, it was excusable. But, yeah, I finally registered on Facebook, and a mutual friend saw my picture on my About page on Gardner Ant with me bumming around Europe as a hippie in 1969, and he said, isn't that so-and-so? And so, you know, within minutes, then I had reconnected with my college boyfriend, who I'd always wondered what happened to him. So, yeah, we dare to go off topic slightly, but I think our readers want us to stay on topic mainly. But I thought this was a fun kind of follow-up to what can happen when you blog.
Uh-huh. Right.
So are you interested in collecting any more contributors?
Well, we love guests. We have Alan is our first regular contributor, but we have we've always had guest posts. Mm-hmm. In fact, Ken Drews recently did a guest post with us.
Yeah, he was just on our show not too long ago.
And so that's a really, we love that. And we do have, if anyone's interested, we have a little something we've written up, kind of giving people guidelines. We like it if it's animated and, you know, mm-hmm. nothing dry. Mm-hmm. So people will sometimes come to us when they say, I've got a rant I want to get off my chest. And they know that we like that.
Now, you cover about five or six gardening zones and 17 time zones here. Is that a problem in terms of, or are you just trying to keep it more generic?
Well, sometimes some things are generic, but I'm a big believer in gardening information being not generic. And right. So I think it's important that you know where the person who's writing is located, where they're gardening. Mm-hmm. And I love it that we do represent different parts of the country, especially with Amy in California. She's got a very different situation. And we have some very frequent writers who are commenters who are like garden designers. There's one in particular in San Francisco. And so I love getting that regional input and also input from the professionals who aren't just talking about these big questions in theory. They really have to get these things implemented, you know, in people's
right.
gardens.
Yeah, and I know you spoke at the National Garden Writers Association meeting. Talk about that a little bit and the response you got there.
That was so much fun. I mean, that room was packed. And really, for a lot of garden writers, they had never even looked at a blog.
Uh-huh.
Right.
So this was blogging 101 to some degree. And so Amy Seward and I from Gardener Ant both spoke. And that's when Alan Armitage was in the audience, and that's when he came running up afterwards and said, can I be the fifth ranter? Because I think he wanted to, he was getting the point, as I think a lot of people in the audience were, that a blog can be, for a garden writer, it can be, it can advance your books. It
right.
can get your name out there as a, uh-huh. as a writer. And I think he wanted a blog, but he didn't want the hassle of doing it himself. And mm-hmm. so just piggybacking onto the Gardener Ant has worked well for him.
Sure.
Well, so we've been happy to see a bunch of writers starting their blogs in the last couple of months.
All right. Well, it's a great blog. I'm not one to read blogs as a sort of garden writer myself.
Right, yeah.
But I will start reading Garden Rant regularly, Susan. Thank you very much.
Great. I'll leave a comment sometime.
Okay. Yeah, Bob knows I can rant from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
At least once
maybe
a week.
Maybe even a guest post from you, huh?
All right.
It'd be fun. Yeah, it's gardenrant.com. We can't forget
That's
that.
Right. Susan, thanks.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Uh-huh. Susan Harris and Garden Rant can be found at gardenrant.com, where you will enjoy posted blogs on gardening by Susan, who's in Tacoma Park, Maryland, Elizabeth Licata in Buffalo, New York, Michelle Owens in Saratoga Springs, New York, and Amy Stewart in Northern California. If you prefer some real perspectives on gardening, you will enjoy Garden Rant, Uprooting the Garden World. Of course, for more information, you can visit our website at wfpl.org.
After the break, we speak with Bob Hopkins about growing American hollies and others. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Blogging Bob Hill here.
Are you going to get inspired to do something worthwhile?
I'm running off madly in all directions at all times. Okay,
so it should be perfect for you.
Don't believe a thing I tell you about anything.
It'll be a rant,
yeah,
to be sure.
Actually, I do rant, but usually between 3 and 4 a.m. But yeah, I can do it then. I can get up and go rant on my computer and go back to bed.
That's right.
Make the world a better place.
Yes, but we're going to move on for now and rant about some other things or delight in some other things. Hollies. There's so many different kinds of hollies. I think people don't. They think of the American holly as sort of the quintessential holly with the spiny leaves and the shiny green foliage. But there are so many different types of hollies. And we have someone here who specializes in the rare and unusual and unique and odd holly.
And he's got the very common name of Bob. It's Bob Hopkins. He grew up on a farm in Shelby County, which gave him a close connection to plants and the soil, of course. Went to Western Kentucky University and majored in horticulture, but his real holly buzz developed 7 or 8 years ago when he was working in Bernheim. Bob, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk holly buzz and Bernheim. How'd this happen?
Well, I ended up working out of Bernheim under Paul Capiello, mm-hmm, and was put into the position of the holly collection there as a hort tech. And my first experience, I just was kind of thrown in with the Holly Society of America. That was kind of my first exposure into hollies and people that were really enthused about hollies. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of blossomed from there, and I ended up starting propagation of hollies about a year or two later, mm-hmm, after I left Bernheim.
Yeah.
It's kind of blossomed from there.
Because you have your own nursery, Teensy Nursery.
Yes.
That is all that you do, holly propagation?
Yes.
Essentially? Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the propagation aspect before we get into hollies themselves. How does that happen? How do you make baby hollies, and where do they go from there?
Well, basically, for me, I propagate everything in the summertime. You can do it in the wintertime through like December and January, mm-hmm, if you have bottom heat. For me, in the summertime, I'll have, it's important to have mist and to be able to keep the humidity high. So, and then I don't have to have the bottom heat at that point in time.
But when you propagate hollies, do you do all this by like stem cuttings?
Stem cuttings, yes.
So you root them out and, mm-hmm, then hope for the best.
Yes, I use a rooting hormone, like Dip and Grow. Mm-hmm. You could use that. Mm-hmm. And so as long as you have your hormone and then a rooting media, they use a peat perlite base. Mm-hmm. And mist, and just wait for time.
So how long does it usually take to get, I suspect it depends on the species, but how long does it typically take to get something that's sellable?
Well, to get it rooted probably, mm-hmm, takes anywhere between, depending on the variety of holly, mm-hmm, anywhere from probably 4 weeks to 8 weeks.
Okay.
To get something rooted. To get it up for like a deciduous holly, to get that into 3 gallons, about 17 months. Mm-hmm. So you're looking, and the American hollies are, it's hard to get a nice looking plant for the first 5 years. Mm-hmm. And then it'll start looking a lot better once it gets up past that 5 year mark.
Mm-hmm. Awkward in its youth.
Yeah, but beautiful when it gets old.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, you mentioned deciduous holly, so let's begin there because that's one you think about in the wintertime a lot. Talk about the plant and its attributes and why you propagate it and why people should have it.
Well, with a deciduous holly, I mean, you can have different berry set over a different period of time. Like some of the early, there's early females and there's early early females, which you need an early male for. Mm-hmm. And then late females and then a late male.
Yeah, and the females have the berries and the males are just kind of quietly proud of it.
Yes.
They don't have the berries, but they both bloom at the same time.
That's the trick.
Yeah,
that's the problem, because with the early females, they'll bloom earlier, probably about a month earlier, so you don't have that overlap in between. So I mean, you definitely have to have a early male to like Jim Dandy to go with the females.
Mm-hmm. And then, when you say that overlap, you mean between the deciduous hollies versus the,
well, just the verticillatas.
Okay, just the verticillatas. So just making sure that you have male-female complement in terms of when that bloom time is.
Yes.
Okay,
and we talk about deciduous hollies here a lot because I love them, but basically it's a plant that I describe it as fairly nondescript until fall. It has this incredible berry set and these beautiful berries around there for months for me anyway. And then next spring, they go back to being nondescript again for a while, but they're worth having just for the winter interest.
Yes. I mean, and the variety, too, that you get, I mean, as far as sizes, like the early the early females, like, they'll just run off some names, like Bright Horizon, Early Bright, Stoplight, Maryland Beauty. Those are some that stay under about 6 foot. Mm-hmm. So they aren't really large for the landscape, so they fit in pretty well. Red Sprite is a smaller one, potentially 4 foot. It's supposed to stay about 3, but it'll get up about 4 foot. Mm-hmm. And it has some of the larger berries. For the late females, Winter Red, you got Sparkleberry, Winter Gold, Chrysocarpa. Chrysocarpa is a yellow-berried form. They all would be later, but they're a lot larger. Mm-hmm. They get up probably about 9 foot, potentially a little larger over time.
Uh-huh. In that category of deciduous holly as well, there's two different species, right? I mean, like the verticillata and then the decidua.
Yes.
So you're speaking of verticillata.
Verticillata only right now.
Only. Okay. Yes. And is there in your mind an advantage over verticillata compared to the decidua? I mean, you know what I mean? It's like, is one better than the other or more suited to your average landscape than the other?
Probably verticillata would be more suited for us. If you could fit it in your landscape, mm-hmm. it's a smaller plant than decidua. Decidua, Ilex decidua, potentially has the chance to get up to about 20 foot tall.
So almost more for your larger landscapes or more of a naturalized landscape, decidua yeah. would fit. But for verticillata, yes. it's going to fit up most other landscapes.
And you can also trim the deciduas. The nice thing about them, you can trim them into a tree form.
Mm-hmm.
And if you at Bernheim Arboretum, they have a really nice stand. There's probably about 9 Ilex deciduas all in tree form. And then there's another bed with them in shrub form. Mm-hmm. So you can see both aspects.
Yeah, another thing about those berries is the birds like them. I mean, it breaks my heart to see cedar waxwings come in there and wipe out after waiting for 11 months to see these things. But if you love birds and want to feed the birds, it's a good choice for people too.
Mm-hmm. Usually they last pretty far through the... through the winter, though. So you get to enjoy them, and then the birds come in and clean them up by the end of the season, it seems. Yeah.
Yes.
So what other hollies are you interested in at TNZ?
Well, I produce some of the Ilex opacas, the mm-hmm. American hollies, some Ilex crenata, the Japanese hollies. I also produce Ilex coniana. It's the hybrid hollies. There's a nice stand down at Bernheim.
Mm-hmm.
They're listed as Zone 7. But and they kind of cross over into 6, I think,
mm-hmm.
because some of those are my favorite because they have potentially they put on 2 feet a year, so it's a nice fast growing plant.
And what do they look like?
It's more of a tall upright plant when it's growing,
mm-hmm.
Potentially about 20 to 30 feet tall, probably about 20 feet wide.
And the foliage
over time, and that's over a 30-year period.
And what's the foliage look like?
The leaves are larger than your typical American hollies.
Okay, but it does have that American holly sort of look to it?
Not really. It has red berries to it. Uh-huh. It does have spines, but they aren't real sharp.
Okay.
It's more of an elongated leaf,
mm-hmm.
so it's a little longer. Most of the American hollies are about size of half dollar mm-hmm. around there.
So since this one's sort of on the border of the zone, so to speak, do you feel like there are chances of success as for the coniana to sort of take its hold in Kentuckiana?
I think potentially it could, mm-hmm. depending on the spot. I have some planted out on my farm in Shelby County at my dad's place. And they seem to be doing fine there. And it's full exposure to wind and full sun.
Mm-hmm.
The ones at Bernheim are protected by a screen and a woodland planting. So I think in the right situation, probably would do really well. And I know in the Maryland and the New England area, they're growing a lot of them up there, and they're mm-hmm. making a push on those. It's basically just public knowledge of what's out there. It's not a plant that a lot of nurserymen are going to jump on and grow just because of there's not a lot out there to choose from.
Uh-huh.
And there's probably about 6 to 8 females and a couple males that are really good plants.
What are some of the cultivar names?
Lassie is one of the females.
Good name.
Lock Raven is one of the males that could go with Lassie. Mm-hmm. There's Agena. It's a female. And Ajax is the male that goes with that. There's, Adonis is one of the males that goes with Venus. And Venus is a nice one.
I hope so.
Okay.
It's got it's instead of a longer leaf, it's kind of a little fatter leaf to it, and mm-hmm. a little shorter.
Now, how far does the male have to be away from the female and still be able to work and pollinate without being in sight, maybe?
Depends on which species you're looking at. American Hollies can go a lot further. I mean, like a mile, 2 miles.
Oh, really? That's
Foster Hollies. Mm-hmm. Foster Hollies. They could have a little bit further range. Verticillatas, you want them in the same yard or within the same bed. It'd be nice to plant a mass planting close together and do about one male per every 4, 5, 6 females.
Mm-hmm. So if you want a specimen American Holly female, if you think your neighbors have males, you know they have a male within a half a mile.
You'd probably be okay planting a female.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it the bees that do the work?
The male.
I'm sorry. The bees haul the pollen around? And
bees, flies, whatever insects get in the flower.
Okay. How about lining the sidewalk or the foundation? What's a good holly for a homeowner?
For the sidewalk, the foundation, I would say there's a number of them. You could use some of the Meserve hollies, like Golden Girl, China Girl.
Has Golden Girl got a golden leaf, it sounds like it? Right?
No, it has a gold berry.
Oh, okay.
Or yellow berry.
Okay. China Girl's got the red berry?
Yes.
Okay.
But then, I mean, those are some of your standard plants that are fairly easy to find.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You could use inkberries and inkberries, Japanese hollies. There's a lot of different plants you can use depending on what you want, what you're going for. I mean, you can mix in some deciduous hollies in there too, just to, from variation. You have some berries in the fall too.
Mm-hmm.
Go with some of the smaller ones like red sprite.
Mm-hmm.
So are there particular considerations in terms of some of the different holly species, you know, clay soils, drainage, wet areas, etc.? Are there some that perform exceedingly well in some of the more difficult situations that people find themselves in?
With the deciduous hollies, they do well within moist situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can be dry, but basically you want the soil to be well drained if possible.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese hollies won't tolerate wet soil at all. They'll just die in a heartbeat. The deciduous hollies, they'll do well in moist soils. They're native to banks along the river and the creeks.
Mm-hmm.
The conianas will do well in moist situations and poor soil conditions.
Mm-hmm.
The opacas, they do fairly well in any type of soil.
Which is the American holly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
When and how do you prune these hollies for the best berries?
Well, what you want to do is basically the flowers are going to be formed on previous year's growth. So you don't want to cut, if you want berries in the fall, you don't want to cut off that new growth from a landscape point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you're wanting to create a bushier plant and you really don't care about the berries, you just want to create a better plant, you'll cut that new growth off right before it flushes in the spring. You want to cut that growth back, and then that'll branch at those nodes, the below that cut.
Make it a little bushier.
Yes.
Uh-huh. We've always pruned American hollies especially, but we've always pruned about this time because it's the holidays. You can use them for decoration. You can, you know, the berries are there already, so you know what you're removing. Is that a decent time of the year to, you know, and the deciduous hollies are beautiful, laden in gold and red berries right now as well, which is great decoration. Is this a good time of the year to take on those chores?
Yes, because, I mean, there's nothing that you're going to do to hurt the plant because basically, I mean, you could take your cuttings at this point in time if you're going to propagate,
mm-hmm.
and you just have to have bottom heat.
Mm-hmm.
But for the decorations, I mean, that's the best time, I mean, for harvesting cut holly.
Mm-hmm.
They'll cut everything within the last month and then box it and just ship it where it needs to go.
Uh-huh. Well, that's convenient, isn't it?
I guess. How about just general upkeep of hollies? Do you fertilize them in the spring or fall, or how do you take care of them?
Well, I fertilize mine early in the spring. I mean, you could use holly tone or just something that's not real heavy in phosphorus and potassium.
Are they, you know, specific to soil pH, that sort of thing? Can they get chlorotic?
Yes. On a pH, typically you want it around 6, 6.5.
Okay.
Right around there.
So that would be
on the acidic side.
Slightly acidic, yeah. Are there particular pests that actually attack different holly trees? Things that we should sort of, you know, be mindful of in the spring of the year?
American hollies, leaf miner, mm-hmm. the Jap hollies, you have spider mites, usually about May to July,
mm-hmm.
depending on that.
Mm-hmm.
What's leaf miner look like on a plant? How do you know you got it?
A leaf miner basically looks like just looks like a little vein. That's, I mean, you'll have a dark leaf, and you'll have this kind of olive-colored squiggly line that makes the, it deforms a leaf. And sometimes it's like a little brown lesion in the leaf.
Mm-hmm. What's the cure for that?
You would basically want to spray that plant right during its flower time, because that's when the insect emerges, and you want to basically coat the plant, and hopefully you won't have any problem with leaf miners.
Yeah. We often get holly berry midge. So, like, you all excited, and your hollies are fruiting, and then they dry up and are brown and ugly. Is it the same sort of control measure as you would with the leaf miners?
Well, actually, with midge, that's about the same spray time. You mm-hmm. want to watch. It's all within the blooming of the plant.
Okay.
To watch that window. But with the midge, your berry would just, it won't turn color at all. Uh-huh. It'll stay green.
Okay.
And then it'll just die.
Do you have any sense that hollies are getting more popular than they were, or about the same, or declining? Or
I would tend to lean towards they're getting a little more popular. I mean, they were really popular back in probably the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a huge amount of people in the Holly Society. It was really active at that point in time. And now we're kind of in a downward growth, but we're kind of creeping back up. And hopefully, with the promotion of plants that the Holly Society of America is doing, that it will kind of rejuvenate and bring on some new plants. And there's a couple guys, Dr. Elwin Orton, he's patented some new plants coming out in hollies. Like Red Beauty's a really nice one.
Mm-hmm.
And he's responsible for Dan Fenton, which is an American holly. He's got another one that he introduced, Portia Orton. He named that after his wife. And everything he produces is really top quality plants. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if he's producing it, it's a nice plant.
Yeah.
And Jersey Knight is a really nice male. It probably beats even some of the females.
I think that's one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah. Even though it doesn't have fruit, it probably uh-huh. is one of the better-looking plants.
That one and Chief Paduke
mm-hmm.
I like.
Oh, yeah. The leaf.
Nice one. So Bob, in terms of hollies being propagated by stem cuttings versus hollies, you know, having a lot of property and land, I've got holly seedlings, you know, from American hollies and other species as well that pop up. Are the seedlings just something you kind of have to watch and see if it comes true? Is it going to be more wild in nature, you know?
Well, predominantly those are going to turn out to be males.
Okay.
For the most part.
Mm-hmm.
They're okay, but they won't miss. When you're selecting hollies, you really want to have something that's going to have the best characteristics as far as growth habit, fruiting, just the whole habit of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
With a wild grown plant, it won't necessarily have
any of
those characteristics
okay.
that you're looking for. You might stumble across something really great, but the likelihood of that's really small.
Okay.
So
don't try to transplant all my holly seedlings everywhere to like a new holly grove out at the farm.
Well, you can. I mean, there's something to be said about that. My grandfather planted one in our yard and it's doing fine. It's a male, unfortunately.
Uh-huh. But we need the males as well yeah. for the females.
But yeah. I'd rather have a Jersey Knight.
Yeah.
since it has to take up the space anyway,
mm-hmm.
it'd be really nice just to pick the plant that you okay. want to be there.
I but hear you.
I've got a 25-foot male. In defense of males here.
Yes. No, I think every yard needs a male holly.
I got a 25-foot male in my yard. It's the most fragrant thing in the yard for about 2 weeks. It's mm-hmm. just incredible. So I love it.
Good.
Bob, thank you very much. Enjoyed having you.
Thank you.
Holly expert Bob Hopkins is the owner of TNZ Nursery in Oldham County. For more information on Bob, his nursery, or how you can join the Holly Society of America, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishing.
I've got a question for you. You've got a question for me.
All right.
That's what America's all about.
Would you like to start, sir?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
This is from Jane in Westport.
Okay.
This was a question I think you should answer, kiddo. I'm going to listen to.
Okay.
Do you know what variety of pumpkins are used in canned pumpkins? Also, what variety of green chili peppers are in the canned, non-spicy kinds? Jane in Westport.
That's a good question. And I think that mass production wise, it's probably the old standby, the you call them small sugar pumpkins, or the New England pie pumpkin.
Okay.
I mean, haven't you heard? Well, that's a pie pumpkin.
Yes.
And typically the pie pumpkins are smaller pumpkins, not the big old jack-o'-lantern
right.
pumpkins, right?
Yep.
There's some more flesh inside of the pumpkin as opposed to a hollow area inside of the pumpkin. So it makes sense.
To be scientific.
And it's sweeter. So if you look at your seed catalogs, you will see clear indications as to how this pumpkin is best to use, and it will be labeled as a pie pumpkin or a sugar pumpkin, and typically they are smaller pumpkins. I think there's a couple of All America selections from last couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Like Baby Bear or something like that. There were some really nice little pumpkins that came out, so you know, just look at your seed catalogs. Chili peppers, I think your average, if you buy green chilies, you know, like in a can or whatever, mild green chilies, I think that's typically an Anaheim chili, Bob. But I'm not really sure.
Well, you know,
but Anaheims are just kind of basic. They're not real hot, plain.
We're from California.
But again, look at your seed catalogs, and they're going to be varieties and clear descriptions in terms of, you know, mild chilies, that sort of thing. So, because honestly, I don't know if like all the places that canned chilies and canned pumpkins are using the exact same variety, you know?
But
I have no idea.
I trust your word again.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Bob, how about this one? I overbought tulips this year. They are my favorite. Now I wish to put many in several round planters, but I'm not sure if I should keep the planters with the soil and bulbs, of course, planted in them, inside, outside, or in the garage.
Well, inside's a real bad idea because they need about 6 weeks of chill at least before the little bulbs kick in for the spring. I think outside is probably the second best. If you can keep them in the garage in your planter, I think they'll get cool enough to work. It'll keep the varmints away from them. And then when they'll start kicking out in the spring, you'll have them intact and ready to go. It sounds like a great idea. Outside is probably the least.
Yeah. I mean, but like if you had an outside, you know, because there's some corners of our house where I could put a pot that would be kind of nice and protected. It's just that you don't want them super duper freezing.
Right.
So the garage will get them adequate cooling without freezing. Plus, if you have a really nice pot, like ceramic pots, those can get messed up if you leave them out in the weather.
That's right. The rain and the freeze and the thaw will get them.
Yeah, exactly. But
that sounds like a neat, tulips and pots just sounds neat. It kind of warms my heart for spring.
It does.
Which is only 6 years away, I think.
Yeah, it's not too far away. Far away. You've got garden blogs to concentrate on.
That's true. If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org. Call us at 814-8246. Or you've only got a couple weeks till Christmas. We could use a card.
We actually
with some handwritten letters on it.
We got one today.
We did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
You got one or me?
I got one.
Oh, man.
I'll share it with you.
Okay.
But we want more.
We want more. It's Christmas.
All right. There we go.
Send more or else to 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202, and address it to Bob and Janine. Thank you.
Well, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us this
another
week?
Another huge surprise for me and you.
Good.
I love doing these plant stories because I learn things all the time.
That's good.
The magnolia.
Yes.
I had no idea. Of course, we're familiar with the magnolia. We love it in the spring. I've got literally 20 of them at home. I just can't wait till April, although sometimes the late frost.
Yeah, sometimes it comes and goes without.
But I don't care. It's just worth having it the years that you do have it. There's so many. The star magnolia, the stellata. Mm-hmm. That's the star-shaped one that comes out before the leaves come on. The grandiflora, the big old southern magnolias with the big fat green leaves.
Right.
It's the state flower of Mississippi and Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
The sweet bay, you've got that, right?
Yeah.
The Virginiana.
We've got some southern magnolias that are beautiful.
I love them.
Protected areas.
And they're protected. Very fragrant.
Uh-huh.
There's the big leaf, the macrophylla, the cucumber.
We've got that. We've
the
got
cucumber
that.
Magnolia.
Uh-huh.
Hey, you're going good.
Acuminata.
The saucer magnolia.
Mm-hmm.
Saluggiana.
Mm-hmm.
Yellow, white, pink, peach, red, you name it. It's fine.
Tulip?
Exactly.
Tulip magnolia?
Tulip magnolia, all those. Here's the neat part. It was named for a guy named Pierre Magnol.
But of course.
I know a Frenchman. He was a botanist and doctor born in 1638. He was the guy that came up with the concept of plant families used in classifications by Linnaeus, among others.
Okay.
All the similar attributes were grouped together. Mm-hmm. This guy thought of that, Magnol. Magnolias themselves are interesting because the movement of the seeds in the glaciers and the continents, they've developed in the East and Southeast Asia, as well as North America, Central America, and South America. They're all over the world.
Wow.
Fossilized specimens go from 20 to 90 million years old.
Huh.
I had no idea.
Move over, ginkgo.
I know it. Here's what's fun, too. It evolved before the bees appeared in the world.
So?
One reason the flowers are so thick and heavy on magnolias is because they're pollinated by beetles.
Huh.
And so the beetles wouldn't eat up all the flowers, or the carpal,
sure.
The carpals they call it. That's why they're so thick.
Wow.
Held on to that for 90 million years. Mm. Medicinal quality of the plant goes back to China in the year 10,083. Mm-hmm. The Spanish conquerors of Mexico in 1500 made reference to them. The first plant was sent to Europe from North America in 1688 when a missionary and plant collector named John Bannister sent a Sweet Bay Magnolia to the Bishop of London. After that, the plant hunters in Asia sent them back to Europe, and the whole hybridization thing has gone on.
Yeah, because the Sweet Bay is Virginiana, right?
Right.
And Virginiana had to do with...
Virginia.
Well, right, and the Virgin.
North America, right.
The Virgin Queen kind of thing, too.
But it was shipped back to Europe. So it's all kind of mixed together and messed together. My favorite's the Daybreak. Have you ever seen that? It's got a beautiful, got a beautiful pink flower. It's an incredible plant. It's been used for medicine, for cough and intestinal problems, for food as a vegetable served with rice, as timber with furniture, utensils, cabinet, and floors. The leaves are fed to the silkworms, and the Native Americans would not sleep under it for fear the fragrance would kill them.
Huh.
You know, they'd be under there, and the fragrance, they would die. And there were some cultures where they believed that having a blossom in the bedroom was a cause of death for the eternal sleep.
I wonder why.
The poor magnolia. I guess that's sweet fragrance.
I guess.
There's a poem about this.
Of course.
Now, here's a plant story whose history will fool you. It's the beautiful, glorious, stupendous magnolia. With fragrance so sweet as to steal away your breath, which is why its presence could mean imminent death. It's been around Mother Earth for a zillion years, source of wonder, awe, headache, cure, and cheers. Be it star, grandiflora, big leaf, or cucumber, its gardening fans are millions in...
number.
Atta girl. So old its first lovers were the ubiquitous beetle, long before bees could give it the needle. Name for a man whose tale is rarely told. A Frenchman, a botanist, the forgotten Pierre Magnol.
Magnol.
A history for all who seek lasting fame and great power. Just don't let it depend on a beautiful flower. Magnolia. Pierre Magnol.
Our last tree to die due to deer activity.
Yeah.
Was a little Sweet Bay Magnolia, by the way. Well, we'll try again.
Yeah.
That was a good plant story, Bob.
I never heard of this guy.
I know. Well, now you have.
Yeah.
Thank goodness you listened to Homegrown. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, how to grow and overwinter tender plants.
Homegrown is produced by the always tender Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.